This episode of the Star Wars Report podcast is brought to you by Geek Fuel, a mystery subscription box for geeks, gamers, and Star Wars fans. Get your free bonus Star Wars item when you sign up at geekfuel.com/Star Wars Report. And Entertain Art, official, licensed, and ready to hang wall art from Disney, Marvel, DC, and so many more studios. Plenty of amazing Rogue One artwork available. Make sure you go to starwarsreport.com/art and use discount code SWR20 for 20% off. Let's get on with the show! Coming up on the Star Wars Report podcast, we talk to the man behind the voice of Tarkin in the Clone Wars and Rebels, and most importantly, Admiral freaking Raddus, Stephen Stanton, right now. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It's the Star Wars Report podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome. So excited to have you on. I'm your host, Riley Blanton. Hey, I just got off the phone with one of the coolest people ever. It's Stephen Stanton, ladies and gentlemen. We've got an incredible conversation and episode. It starts right now, folks. I can't believe... Man, these are just some really cool folks. Now Stephen and his crew of folks, Dutch and Kathy, have been a huge, longtime supporters of the Star Wars Report since like we'd barely started it. In fact, if I were to... I wonder when our first episode is. In fact, I'm going to do something that you should never do on podcasting and Google Stephen Stanton Star Wars Report. I wonder, because I bet our first episode would actually come up. It was early on in like the first less than 100 episodes. And it was such a pleasure because we had just gotten started. They just introduced us. They supported us, and we got out to Star Wars Fan Days. It was like the show had barely begun. I won't bore you guys with all the details of the history, but suffice to say, Stephen and his crew are just absolutely amazing people. And of course, he's an incredibly talented voice actor with a lot of insight into not just Star Wars and Tarkin and Admiral Raddus and that sort of thing, but really, we have a great conversation about kind of the tradition of Star Wars and old Hollywood films that influenced it. And it's just an overall awesome conversation. And I won't delay any further. Let's get started with the show right now. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Star Wars Report podcast, the Thursday edition. And I'm very, very excited to bring on a good friend, a longtime friend and supporter of the program here, and an all-around amazing, amazing guy. I'll tell you what, ladies and gentlemen, I can introduce parts of this man's incredible credits list, but I just now realized we would be here all night. He's voiced everything. He's a voice actor extraordinaire. Star Wars fans, you know him, of course, as the voice of Tarkin in Star Wars: The Clone Wars and Star Wars Rebels. It's Stephen Stanton, everybody. Welcome.
Wow, thank you, Riley, and the Star Wars Report. What a grand introduction. I was wondering, listening to that, who that was you were bringing on the show. I was just a little mystified there, but no, thank you. Glad to be back.
Absolutely, man. Well, tell me all about how's life going in Star Wars. I'll tell you what, Star Wars has been, it's been a while. I'm trying to remember the last time we had you on the show, but so much has been happening with Star Wars, with Rogue One, with Star Wars Rebels and stuff. Just like, where's Stephen the Star Wars fan these days?
Well, Stephen, the Star Wars fan, is very excited because Stephen, the voice actor, has gotten to do so much Star Wars here in the last year and had to keep secret about it for so long. But yeah, there's been so much going on with the show and with Rogue One, which I'm very, very proud, very honored to be a part of. It's just been nonstop, and I think I don't see it slowing down anytime soon. Tell you the truth. Right now.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. Stephen, we're crazy, right? First of all, and we did this like daily countdown podcast for the last 30 days to Rogue One. And I thought, you know what? There's so much news, so much excitement with Star Wars. We'll do a nightly show for the next 30 days. And I still left stuff out. It was crazy, man. Like we're still in the aftermath of Rogue One. On earlier this week, we were just talking about still stuff we're learning about the movie, about, you know, Gareth Edwards' cameo in the movie and more information about just how that film unfolded, all the changes that took place. But I there's all kinds of things that I want to talk to you about, but I would be mad at myself if I didn't just start off with Admiral Raddus.
That sounds like a good place to start.
Let me tell you about Admiral Raddus. I mean, like, why do I need to tell you about it? Let me tell you about my love affair with the Admiral. Of course, based loosely on Winston Churchill. I sound like I'm doing some kind of BBC. Based loosely on the character of Winston Churchill, Admiral Raddus led the rebellion fleet. No, all right, I'll stop. But no, seriously, he became this almost memeified character on the show in the lead up. I already knew I would like him, but in the movie, the fact that he just doesn't give a crap, that Admiral Raddus is there and he understands the threat of the Empire, and more importantly, he's not messing around. You know, forget all this political talk. It's time for the fleet to show up. And like the one moment, even the first time I saw the movie, I noticed so much more the subsequent times, but the first time I saw the movie, and they're like, we should probably head off to Scarif, right? And they're like, Admiral Raddus has already left with the fleet. And I'm like, of course he has, because he's Admiral freaking Raddus. It was so much fun. Tell me all about it. All right, tell me about the process, how you voiced him, how the character was developed. I want to know all about it.
Oh, okay. Where do I begin? All right, let's start with the audition process. So, as you know, Lucasfilm has a grand tradition of secretly disguising scripts and auditions and things from the actors, so you don't really know what it is that you're working on, even if you're in the films. You know, we've done that on the Clone Wars, where on the series finale, you know, everyone was, T.C. Carson was looking at me and says, like, how come I only have 18 pages? How many do you have? And like, well, I have 21. And then, you know, you went down the line, and it was one of those things where as you finished, you had to leave the room, you know, so until when everyone was done, it was only the last couple people left in the room doing a little bit of dialogue, which at that time was Ashley and Matt Lanter. Wow. So in the case of Rogue One, I got an audition from my agent, and it was one of these sort of mysterious things that comes down the pike so often these days, where it's like, it's a secret project, we can't tell you what it is. And it's like, okay, so I don't know if it's a TV show or if it's a feature film or what the heck this is. And all they said was like, here's the description. We're looking for something that's like a cross between Winston Churchill and General George Patton. And here's the dialogue. And that was it. So when I auditioned for it, I did not know I was working for auditioning for Star Wars, and I certainly didn't know it was for Rogue One.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I kind of like went and said, okay, let me familiarize myself with Winston Churchill. And, you know, when most people say they want something to sound like Patton, they really mean they want it to sound like George C. Scott in the movie. Because if you listen to Patton and his speeches, he has a very sort of like an Eastern Seaboard vocal tonality, you know. It's not what George C. Scott sounds like.
Yeah.
So I kind of, you know, I listened to the, you know, it's like, I know what George C. Scott sounds like and Pat, you know, and you listen to Winston Churchill and, you know, we will fight them on the beaches and you combine the two and you get Admiral Raddus.
And there he is. Sorry, you just made
exactly, or whoever it was, you know, they had it was a fake name that was attached to the character at the time when I did this. So I submitted that, and you know, you never know how long it's going to be. You know, if you don't book the job, you never hear anything back.
Yeah.
So in this case, I heard back just a few days later. My agent said, "You're booked, and it's just a character for the new Star Wars project, Rogue One." So I was super excited that's what it was, because for me, I mean, I was excited about The Force Awakens. I'm excited about all the new, projects that are coming out of Lucasfilm, you know, but Rogue One was a throwback to the very first Star Wars film, the one that, you know, that I saw when I was when I was a kid. So this was the one I really was hoping somehow to be associated with on some level. So I was glad that I was going in to do this character, and I had no idea what his role was or how big of a role he had in the film.
And he had a pretty significant one, but it's interesting because whenever you land a role in a Star Wars movie, there's got to be something just about that process where, like, looking way back in history, the Stormtrooper number 3 in A New Hope probably didn't think he would be at, you know, a Star Wars celebration 40 years later, but even just to have like a cameo role is enormously significant just in pop culture in general. If you're seen on screen, it's a big deal, especially to Star Wars fans like us. But Admiral Raddus is an example of so many really cool characters that may not have a ton of screen time, but man, his presence is the perfect counterbalance to everything happening in the film, because it would have been very easy, I think, for Mon Mothma or even Diego Luna and Felicity Jones's characters, like just to have the main characters be the one that are all rah rah, we're gonna go take them out. But the guy who starts it in the film is Raddus. What is that process like? It's gotta take us a little bit behind the scenes of when you're developing a character like this. Not just the voice, but do they give you like any visual references, or do you kind of have an understanding of what's happening around you? And like, how much are you injecting to the process of developing the character? I'm genuinely scared. I have no idea how this happens.
Well, at the point of the audition, you get virtually nothing.
Yeah.
Because there's so much secrecy around it. So you get the dialogue, which is, of course, modified from what is actually done in the film, because they always try to change it so that you don't have any clue that you're auditioning for a Star Wars film. So there's no picture of the character. You don't have any idea what it looks like physically or anything like that. They just had the barest of descriptions. Like I said, they were describing a military leader with a cross between Winston Churchill and Patton, not just vocally, but, you know, and just in personality wise too. And that's really all you had to go on. That's it. There was nothing more. And you don't find out anything. I mean, I had no idea he was, this was Mon Calamari until I got to the session. I went to the Disney lot.
Oh,
and
wow.
Matthew Wood is there saying, okay, here's the real character name. And he says, you know, we're going to show you what he looks like. And it's this character. You know, and it's like, oh, okay, that's the Mon Cal that we saw, Mon Calamari that we saw, like, in some of the behind-the-scenes stuff. But I didn't know that until I actually got to the session.
So in the session, let me just ask you about another favorite. Sorry, I apologize, Steven. I'm just going to geek out a lot about Rogue One in this conversation. Did you have an idea of the incredible thing that was going to happen on screen when you said the line, "Get the Hammerhead Corvette"? Because
no.
Oh, wow. So
no,
that was a surprise to you.
Well, here's the thing. When you get to this, on one of these sessions like this, you know, this is ADR session. So that means you're going in and you're laying down dialogue to footage that's already been shot. However, the footage is not complete. So when I was looking at Admiral Raddus in his spaceship, everything that I could see outside the windows was just green screen.
Yeah.
There was nothing there. The compositing wasn't finished yet. So I had no idea what he was looking at. I had no idea where in the film this particular battle was taking place. I had no clue that it was part of the finale. And, you know, I was just being directed by, you know, the people in London. Just saying, okay, here's a little bit about what's going on in the scene. And they would just give you just enough so they could get the correct emotional intent from you that they were looking for. I still had no visual reference as to what was going on that Raddus was looking at.
Yeah, no, that I mean, it makes sense when you put it that way. It's fascinating because, you know, we just see the final product. It's so cool because it's such a significant part of the film. I mean, it's really the turning point of the movie. And I don't know. It's one of those things that I imagined that we just played as kids, and to see that kind of realized on the screen is so significant. Do you have it, looking back on it, do you have any like favorite moments in the studio, and were you able to voice with, or is it with others, or are you just by yourself in the studio when you're recording?
In this particular case, and in cases like this, you're by yourself in the sense that there are no other actors around. So what happened was that Matthew Wood was supervising the session at Disney, and Doc Kane, who is a legend in his own right on the Disney ADR and recordings stages, he was there running the control and engineering it. And then we had the crew in London directing me. And so, you know, you're there and I've got my like 6 pages of dialogue. All of a sudden, it's like, wow, this character has a lot to say. And, you know, so we go through line by line, scene by scene. And of course, once they showed me what it was, that it was a Mon Cal, I'd say, okay, this is as important as Akbar in Return of the Jedi. Now, we all know that Eric Bauerfeld, who voiced Akbar, passed away. not that long ago. So I was immediately seeing this as like, this is a salute and this is an homage to what Eric brought to the character, you know, in the original trilogy. It's just another version of that species, but you know, we're just kind of like bringing it full circle. And everybody loves Akbar, right? I mean, come on. Yeah, how can you not? So this was a way of bringing that kind of a character back into the film without it being just Akbar himself, but being another one of his race, those creatures, that species, being a part of the rebellion. So you could see they were really involved in more than one way. And so once you start seeing that, it's like, here's the character, this is what he looks like, and you realize how important it is, then you know, at least in my case, I'm thinking, okay, I've got to really do justice to this character, because this is not just a new alien species that we're seeing. This is the Mon Calamari, and they, you know, we know how much they bring to the rebellion.
Yes, yes. And it's such a fun role to watch. And man, Steve, thanks so much for giving us a perspective on that, because it's incredible to me just to kind of see even a brief peek inside that process, because I don't know why, but he and I know this is the case with many characters, but there's some reason that I just immediately fell in love with him. So I appreciate all of your work, but let's fast forward until when you actually got to see the film for the first time. Walk us through your experience actually seeing the finished product.
Well, that was an experience. I mean, I almost can't describe it, because, you know, I didn't see the finished product. So, you know, I saw it in a theater here that's not too far from where I live that we all love to go to. It was a theater built in the 1930s called The Village, and it's got a beautiful balcony and, you know, great sound system and all that stuff. And originally owned by the Fox, it was part of Fox West Coast Theater, so part of originally one of 20th Century Fox's theater chain. So it's got the Star Wars legacy kind of built into it, you know, just naturally. So I'm watching this, and now I get to finally see what Raddus was up against and where, you know, his scenes took place in the film. And I was excited as anybody, like, how's this all going to play out? I mean, I really didn't know. I didn't know what Raddus's fate was. I still don't know exactly what his fate was. Didn't know how that battle was going to go. And I have to be honest to you, you know, when I recorded the line, you know, Rogue One, may the Force be with you. I didn't know, there was no picture for that particular sequence. They just had me record that wild, which means just record it a few different ways based on direction. And then when I saw what he was looking at, you know, my heart broke in two, just like everybody else's in the theater. I mean, I've honestly said, I've never used so much Kleenex, dabbing the tears from my eyes in a Star Wars film than in Rogue One, watching the fate of all those characters one by one as they all become eliminated, giving their lives to this, to the rebellion, was just, it was heartbreaking.
It's such a brave, and I think this is a perfect way to kind of lead into some Rogue One talk, because like we're still seeing it. Like we're still, I was just talking to the podcast producer for us, Bruce, and we were like already planning our next time to see it. I've seen it 6 times so far, and I'm working up from there. And it's incredible that the ending, because whenever I've talked to anyone about Rogue One, the talk immediately has to go to the ending. And it's so gutsy, it's so brave in storytelling that they were willing to sacrifice each of the characters. And I use that term intentionally, Stephen, because it's not, they didn't kill them off, which is a phrase I kind of hate to hear tossed around a lot, because each of the sacrifices happen in such a brutal but beautiful succession where each character has a piece of the puzzle to get the plans to escape the planet. And I just love how beautifully it comes together. It's kind of almost like the inverse, or if you watch Stranger Things, it's like the upside down world version of the end of A New Hope, because instead of each puzzle piece happening and leading to the victory, it's just each puzzle piece coming together and just so that the hope can survive, quite literally, because of the dialogue of the phrase that Leia speaks at the end of the film, hope. And it's just, I just love the ending of the film so much. Yeehaw!
You're listening to the Star Wars Report. The circle is now complete.
That's right, folks. You are listening to the Star Wars Report, and we do want to take a brief time out to thank one of our sponsors for today, and that's Geek Fuel. Geek Fuel is a mystery subscription box that comes out each and every month for geeks, gamers, and Star Wars fans alike. They guarantee $50 of value for just $15 plus shipping and handling. Every box has an exclusive t-shirt and 5 to 7 unique geeky items. And also, if you sign up at geekfuel.com/Star Wars Report, they're going to give you a free bonus Star Wars item of at least $10 value with your first box. Geekfuel.com/Star Wars Report. That's geekfuel.com/Star Wars Report. On with the show.
Well, I think this is one of those films. I mean, as soon as it comes out on Blu-ray, I mean, people are going to snatch this thing up so quick because the repeated viewings and the freeze framing and the back, you know, I mean, this is going to be nonstop on this film because there's so much buried in it. I mean, I'm way behind you. I've only seen it 3 times, but, you know, I kept missing the ghost from Star Wars Rebels. Oh, yeah. I saw it on the landing platform on the planet before we take it off, but I kept missing it in the battle scenes because my attention was diverted in so many different places, and it's such a the movie is such a feast for the eyes. Gareth Edwards is, you know, he's a master at visual effects, as you know if you've seen Godzilla and his previous film before that, Monsters. You know, this guy really has a handle on digital effects and how to utilize them the best way to tell a story, and I'm just blown away. I mean, I still have a few more viewings in me to go see it at the theater before I'm satisfied. And then I'm going to be doing the same thing as everybody else. I'm grabbing that Blu-ray, the DVD, and just running it over and over.
Yes. No, it was, in fact, we'd seen it several times, and then we did our New Year's Eve tradition of blowing up the Death Star in A New Hope, and I had just seen it. And it really does have an impact on the way you watch the movie. And, you know, I'm always kind of leery of that when someone says, yeah, it'll totally change the way you see it. But like, well, you made it afterwards. You can't change it that much. But it really does. There's something about, and you know what, Stephen, I think this was a big, we were lucky enough, we saw it like on Wednesday night, one night before it came out. We were invited, fortunately, to this sort of not press screen. There were some press there. And so we were in a small press section. But really, they had reserved most of the theater for the public, and it was like local radio contests and things like that, and like some prizes that had been given away by local businesses and some really grassroots marketing stuff that Disney had put together. So when the film started up, it was just the rowdiest audience ever. And like, man, when Red Squadron and Blue Squadron show up, the place just erupted in not just applause but cheering. It was great.
No, I had actually seen that some of that footage when I was recording, because while I was recording, they were like giving me little bits, like they would give me a little bit of the footage before my scene and a little bit after. So I had the proper context of what I was talking about. And Matt Wood was showing me, he's like, oh, yeah, we got these guys back because we found these unused takes. And I said, oh, my God. Yeah. I said, people are going to go nuts when they see this. I was freaking out. I was asking him right there in the session, can we just stop and play the whole thing, you know, even unfinished so I could just watch this? Because I was so getting into it. You know, ordinarily these days when we're doing ADR, you know, to protect pirating and so forth, a lot of times we're looking at black and white versions of the film. Yeah. With a lot of, you know, watermarking and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
In this case, even though the shots were unfinished, I was looking at color footage. And so I was getting extremely excited. In fact, I'll tell you, the excitement level was so high. Ryan Johnson stopped by to see what we were doing during our session.
What?
You know, so he's like,
wait, what happened?
Everybody wants to see what's going on with Rogue One.
That has to be an amazing experience. And like, the dude was working on the next Star Wars movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, everybody, I think just the curiosity level and just to see how it was coming together, I think the hype and the interest was so high. You know, of all the Star Wars films to be involved with right now, I'm so glad I got a chance to be involved in Rogue, because really it was the one I've been looking forward to the most. I know some people had their reservations about it. To me, it was so special because it was going back to the original Star Wars film. So yes. I wanted to see... You know, let's face it. I mean, when the first one came out, the visual effects were, they're groundbreaking, and they still hold up. I mean, George Lucas, you know, he's gone in and digitally, played around with it and upgraded and so forth. But in many cases, it didn't need to be done. They really held up on their own. And it was so nice to be going back to a film with the modern technology and the modern, you know, sort of like tools of storytelling and filmmaking, and go back and revisit that original stuff and try to recreate it exactly and as precisely as possible as, you know, as it looked in 1977. I was just so excited to be a part of that.
Well, and just as a Star Wars fan, just hearing you tell the story, because I the information had come out in some behind the scenes stuff, but just to know that there were just like film archives just sitting around waiting to be discovered of... from the original Star Wars that had never been seen by the public. Like, that's incredible to me. You know, the inner fan in me is just like, can we get a new inventory, please, maybe?
But when you're making a feature film, especially on that scale, I mean, there's, and, you know, there you get a lot of different takes on everything. And, you know, everything gets developed at the lab, you know. It's not like in the old days where they would say, well, this is a circle take and this is a circle take and only print these things. You know, it's like, you know, by the 1970s, I'm sure they were, printing everything. So they probably had, you know, all of it there. It's just a matter of like going through it and cataloging it.
Yeah. No. And preserving it. That's, you know, man, Stephen, it just leaves me. I'm still wishing for it. I don't think the technology isn't there yet, but there is no shortage of money that Star Wars fans would pay to literally pay for an all access, every behind the scenes, extra bonus footage ever released for a Star Wars film, and just have an ongoing, even if it was a recurring cost, like an annual update, some kind of technology that would allow us to have access to all of this incredible behind the scenes stuff, and so much which I know we haven't seen yet that's in the archives, and certainly stuff that's yet to come. That you're just reminding me of how badly I want this. I don't think the technology just isn't there, but you know, I think it's getting there with like iTunes access passes or something like that. But to have like the Star Wars behind the scenes pass, man, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, that's, you know, I'm sure one day there will be the Lucasfilm channel, and they will have all that stuff available for everyone to see. Because look, this is what happens all the time in the world of film collecting and film restoration. You know, things get put, because I had friends of mine that worked on the special edition as editor and stuff. And you know, it was tough finding things. Things get mislabeled. They get put into a wrong can. Somebody just grabs a whole bunch of trims out of the, you know, the editing bin, and they throw it into a can and stick it off to the side. And it goes unnoticed for years. So yeah, it's always a massive undertaking when you're trying to restore things or look for lost footage, because a lot of times, you know, things can be anywhere. At the end of a film, a lot of people are just kind of like tired of it. They've seen it a million times, and they just want to let's put it in a can, tape it up, throw it in a vault somewhere so we can get on to the next thing, you know, because it's over. It's like, these are things that we didn't use. So it's, we understand saving them, but beyond that, you know, a lot of times things get sort of like a mislabeled, and you know, so who knows what treasures are left to be uncovered in the Star Wars saga.
You know, I'm curious, because I know you mentioned that, because the Star Wars special editions were kind of the foundation of the very idea of going back and uncovering, rediscovering, and revamping a film, especially by its creator, like its creator still being alive and and the creator spearheading it. I'm curious, you know, I'd love to ask you if you have any stories about hearing the discovery of new footage, or perhaps anyone like so many of the new shots that were developed, of what that process is like? Because I know you have a long history, not in just performance, but also visual effects. But before we get there, ladies and gentlemen, I do want to take a time out to thank our sponsor for this episode. And that's, of course, Entertain Art, official, licensed, and ready-to-hang artwork from Disney, Marvel, Star Wars, and so many more studios. We've been working with them for quite some time. They've been supporting the program all the way through the release of Rogue One, and we really appreciate it. Make sure you check out their incredible in-house designs. Of course, tons of Rogue One artwork, and they have high-quality canvas, both embellished and regular, as well as metallic canvas. More than 1,000 designs available. Just go to StarWarsReport.com/art. It's that easy. When you land at entertainart.com, make sure you use discount code SWR20 for 20% off. We thank Entertain Art for supporting the program. Again, StarWarsReport.com/art. Now, Steven, so tell me about, do you have any favorite behind-the-scenes story? Because you've, I think of you, I'm not going to lie, I think of you as sort of a, not just a Hollywood royalty, because you are, like, I and that sounds weird for me to even say out loud, but seriously, like, knowing how involved you've been with Star, but seriously, like, all of your involvement throughout the years of in Star Wars and so many, like I say, so many incredible credits, like, do you have any favorite behind-the-scenes stories related to Star Wars that you've heard or witnessed over the years?
Well, you know, as far as the Star Wars films go, you know, up until Rogue One, I never really personally worked on any of those. I've known a lot of the guys and gals that have worked on those original trilogy films, like Phil Tippett, you know, the stop motion master who, you know, did the most of the stop motion that you've seen in the original trilogy. And Richard Edlund, who is one of the visual effects supervisors and cinematographers, you know, starting with the very first Star Wars film. So, I mean, you know, I'm sure there's tons of stories out there. I don't really have too many myself, other than what I was saying, you know, earlier. That I did have friends that worked on the special editions, and they said it was mind-boggling trying to go back and find all those scenes and redo them, you know, from scratch, you know, and catalog them and just trying, because, you know, it's Hollywood, unfortunately, you know, and this is just, I have a friend of mine who is a part of the UCLA Film Archives. And this is a typical case of it. He was also a projectionist at the Grauman's Chinese Theater when I worked there back in the early 80s. And I remember when we were showing Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, one of the things that he had in his collection, which he just happened to have, God knows how he got a hold of it at some point, it was the what do you call it? The overture for the film Spartacus. And it was among a bunch of other things that he had from Spartacus that were just kind of like he managed to get come across over the years. So what we would do, or what he would do rather, is at the Grauman's, before the Temple of Doom started, he would play the overture to Spartacus, and he would time it so that he would like dim the lights, and as the the overture reached a crescendo, the Paramount logo would shine on the curtain, and the curtains would part, and then Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom would start. By that time, he had whipped the audience into such a frenzy. You know, they were stomping their feet and clapping their hands and all this kind of stuff. Well, you know, time goes by, and they're starting to restore the film Spartacus, and they're looking for pieces, and all of a sudden, my friend has the things that they're looking for. It's like, oh, yeah, we were doing this. You know, we're playing it before, you know, we started you know, Temple of Doom. And so, you know, he hands that stuff off to the guys that are doing the restoration of Spartacus, which is Robert Harris and his crew. And, you know, he just all of a sudden becomes part of history again because he happened to have, you know, stuff that he picked up at a garage sale or traded it. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that you find when you're here in Los Angeles. People that worked in films have things in their garages, in their attics, and sometimes, you know, they don't know what it is. They're going to get rid of it. And that's just how things get lost and get found again.
That's amazing. It gives me hope for Star Wars, because I think there's such a sharp focus on it. But I have an appreciation for that process, because like we grew up watching movies all the time. Because I've mentioned this a few times on the show, but I always like to reiterate it. Like Bethany and I grew up overseas, and we had like a limited couple of VHS tapes that we had. This would have been like the mid 90s. Uh-huh. And we would watch like The Sound of Music. We would watch Casablanca. We'd watch like old episodes of Andy Griffith, but there's this tradition of incredible entertainment that I feel like has that chance in today's age to relive in a renaissance because we have it now that we have archivists actually making this stuff available for us again. And it's as simple as like turning on Netflix and clicking on the show and watching it. And it's just, I love that. That applies as equally as to Star Wars as it does to so many of the things that influenced Star Wars.
Well, no, I think there's a lot of, you know, nowadays people have, especially filmmakers, have a sense of the value of those kinds of things and the public's interest in them. And it's not just, you know, something that they would just put in a vault and forget about. In my own experience, I'll take you back just very quickly to the Grauman's Chinese. When I was working there, they were putting in Lucasfilm was installing the THX system, and it was it was the invention of it. So, you know, they were installing it in a theater, and when they were going backstage, they were the Chinese theater used to have a stage where they had live prologues. So they were throwing out all this junk that had been there since, you know, the 1930s. And I was looking at a box of stuff they were taking out to the trash, and I noticed a couple of cans of film. And I said, whoa, I'll take those. Don't throw those in the dumpster. And I pulled them out. And lo and behold, they were 16-millimeter color film footage of the films of The Agony and the Ecstasy with Rex Harrison and Charlton Heston, and a Julie Andrews film called Star. And recently I went to a friend of mine who's at Photochem, and we had all that stuff digitized and preserved because, you know, there may be something to do with that at some point. But this is a moment in time that would have been lost, literally thrown in the garbage, had I not gone in there and pulled it out.
That is incredible. Yeah, and I'm glad to hear stories like that of you taking that care, because we know that that's the case with Star Wars for sure today. So I just love that idea. And I also, I'm kind of thinking out loud here, and I think we'll close the program on this note. But one thing I've really felt is a shame that, for me personally as a Star Wars fan, I haven't been able to fully appreciate, are so many of the incredible classic Hollywood influences of George Lucas, whether or not it's the Seven Samurai, or whether or not it's some of the old black and white war movies, or whether or not, you know, it's so many of the other films that influenced George Lucas. The Seahawk, one of my favorite films, the old Errol Flynn swashbucklers. I would love to, as a Star Wars fan, have access to, not just because of Star Wars, but because of cinema in general, the things that we love about Star Wars that we haven't even had a chance to appreciate just because of generations. It's funny because I see, when I talk to people all the time, for me, when they say, so, you know, what about, you know, Goonies is one of the greatest films ever. And I'm like, you know, I never saw it. And because it was just before my time. And I think that there's elements like that, even for Star Wars fans of the original generation, where there's that opportunity to appreciate films that influenced Lucas.
I think you're right, because despite the fact that we have access to so much, it's very difficult for people to know where to go to find the things that they're interested in. When I was a kid, I had a little different experience growing up than you did. I grew up where, you know, we had three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, and then we had our UHF channels, which were the independent stations. And between those three networks and your local programming and the UHF stuff, you got to see, it's like we had monster movies on every Friday and Saturday. You just knew it. Every week there was something there to catch up on. When Star Wars became popular, they started showing all the Flash Gordon serials, and we're like, oh, that's where the crawl came from and stuff. Nowadays, I think a lot of, especially for young people, they don't know where to turn to start, to even begin to look for this stuff, because it's not on television in the same way that it used to be. Yeah. You got to go search it out. And in many cases, it's like, look, how many channels do we have? Where do you go? How do you find things? You know, so it's up to people like, you know, it's great. There's people like you out there and there's bloggers and websites that will put together, look at these movies, look at these influences. And if you're interested in this, you know, like the Peter Cushing Appreciation Society in the UK, they're constantly showing and pointing out the other films that Peter Cushing did apart from Star Wars and apart from the Hammer films that he did. So the people kind of really appreciate the body of work that this magnificent actor did over the years. So, you know, there's stuff out there, but it's just, you really got to dig for it.
You did. And you know what, Stephen, you just finished our show really well, because I just, as we were speaking, I just turned around here in the studio, and I have not one, not two, not three, but four whiteboards, because I'm a nut. And I have all kinds of plans and cool things that we're planning for the show, and new things that we're going to be working on throughout the year. And I literally just wrote down, I want to put together a digestible shorthand list of where to start. I think that's because there are a lot of film aficionados that know this stuff, but just for the average Star Wars fan, if you're listening to the Star Wars Report, I think that might be a fun podcast series or blog post, and we'll see if we can't put together something like that to really kind of talk about the different elements of the Star Wars mythology and where you can go rewind history a little bit, and maybe we'll do that. So Stephen, I appreciate it. I can't believe, you know, it's so fun to have the conversation turn where it turned, and man, it's been so rewarding. I wish we had more time, but unfortunately we do have to wrap up the episode. But Stephen, thanks so much. Tell everybody where they can find you online and chat with you and keep up with your ongoing amazing projects in the world of Star Wars and beyond.
Well, mainly I'm mostly active on Twitter nowadays at Steven_Stanton. And you can also find me on Facebook at Steven Stanton. There's a little blue check mark next to the fan page there where you can find out the stuff that's going on. But those are the two main places where you can find out what I'm working on. And I'm over on Instagram too. I'm trying to keep that going, but God, there's so many things to keep in touch with. Twitter's the main place.
Yeah, no, Twitter's great, and Steven's awesome to follow on Twitter. Make sure you follow him. It's at Steven_Stanton. We'll throw the links in the show notes for this episode 260 of the Star Wars Report podcast, which puts the wraps. You can also follow us on social media. Make sure you stay subscribed on iTunes or whatever your podcatcher of choice is, and follow our socials. It's just Star Wars Report everywhere. Twitter/Star Wars Report, Facebook/Star Wars Report. We don't have a Snapchat. Sorry, guys.
neither do I.
I'm not. We're in good company at least. But I do, and it's at the Rally Guy. ding, ding, ding. All right. I'll leave that as it is. Until next time, may the Force be with you, and many Bothans died to bring you this podcast. Steven Stanton, everybody. Man, what an amazing conversation. What an amazing dude. Guys, seriously, thanks so much for tuning into the podcast. Also, quick reminder, I almost forgot to mention, be sure that you send us your emails about Star Wars Celebration. We're doing a series coming up really soon, so any questions you have, tips or tricks, StarWarsReport@gmail.com, StarWarsReport@gmail.com, and we'll be launching that series very soon, so get those emails in. Until next time, we'll see ya! Big shout out to High Adventure. Again, amazing work. Let's do it. That's the show. Let's take it out.